was telling them that.
Good afternoon. We'll call the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development to order. Our apologies for the little delay as they dealt with the technical difficulties of the sound system, but we're ready to go. And we'll open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move the following legislative concepts, LCs, be introduced as committee bills. LC 614, dated October 10, 2012. LC 882, dated December 3, 2012. LC 1030, dated August 31, 2012. And LC 1032, dated September 4, 2012.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved that LC 614, dated October 10, 2012. LC 882, dated December 3rd, 2012, LC 1030, dated August 31st, 2012, and LC 1032, dated September 4th, 2012, be introduced as committee bills, with the standard disclaimer that none of our actions today indicate any support going forward. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections? I don't see any. Motion carries. The bills are introduced as committee bills. The concepts are introduced as committee bills. Close the work session and open an informational meeting. This is the last of our sort of orientation meetings. Colleagues, we're here to hear from ODOT today. Director Garrett, I'd like to get us started and bring whomever you would like with you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of Oregon's Department of Transportation. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and share some thoughts with you on the state of Oregon's transportation system. We're going to speak to the various trends, challenges, and the opportunities that we face in the world of transportation here. We'll speak about who we are as an agency, how our commission works, and then we will talk about the Oregon Transportation Plan, its vision, and the various strategies and initiatives and goals here. With me today, Mr. Chairman, is the rose between the two thorns here, Jerry Bohart, who is the administrator of our Transportation Development Division. They do the planning and the research and the data collection, both for the state and local government needs, to be very honest with you. And then Paul Mather, who is our the administrator of the Highway Division. So let me first do an overview here, then I'll turn it over to Jerry and Paul, who will start to speak to some of the various goals and the strategies that build the framework around those goals within the OTP. We are an agency made up of about 4,500 people. They are dedicated and passionate men and women who deliver transportation services, programs, and projects for Oregonians. I think my folks understand that the more robust the transportation system is, the better the economic health of the state of Oregon is. It's just that simple. We are an agency in evolution. We are transitioning. There's no question about that. And I would submit to you that we are an agency that facilitates the alignment of transportation policy with land use policy, with environmental, economic, safety, and energy policies. And we're working to ensure that these policies converge rather than collide. We're an agency working to realize that the investments that not only address transportation-type challenges and issues, but also meet multiple objectives as we make investments across the state of Oregon. Now, our mission is to provide a safe and efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities across Oregon, or for Oregon, or Oregonians, excuse me. It is a multifaceted mission, there's no doubt. We serve many masters. It's embedded in that saying here. Now, we achieve our mission through the work of 8 divisions that make up the Oregon Department of Transportation. These 8 divisions deliver programs, projects related to Oregon's system of highways, roads, and bridges, program development, research planning, railways, transit systems programs, the safety issues that are woven in everything we do at ODOT, driver and motor vehicle services, DMV, the activities, kind of the face along with our maintenance people. I think they are the face of state government. So the business transactions that take place, whether it's the driver or the vehicle itself, that take place at DMV, motor carriers, this is our relationship relationship with the trucking industry, a regulatory, a business transaction relationship. And then Central Service is the eighth division that becomes the administrative arm of the organization. In addition to ODOT and its men and women, we achieve the mission through the direction of the Oregon Transportation Commission. For all intents and purposes, this commission is our board of directors. The OTC is a five-member volunteer citizens board appointed by the governor with the consent of the Oregon Senate. They oversee the activities of the department here, and specifically they are charged with development and maintaining a state transportation policy and a comprehensive long-term plan for a multimodal transportation system. This is known as the Oregon Transportation Plan, the most current being adopted in 2006. I'm going to speak to that a little bit later, and then Jerry and Paul will dive deeper into the specific goals that are embedded into the OTP. Our commissioners during the 2013 legislative session are as follows. Pat Egan is our chair. He's from the Portland metro area. Mr. Egan's in the utility business but has an extensive background in state government, working several different positions here. Knows the ins and outs of transportation. Mary Olson, also from the Portland area. Mary comes from a financial background. Dave Lohman, he's an attorney from Southern Oregon, the Medford-Ashland area. Tammy Bainey from Bend. She's a Deschutes County Commissioner. And then Mark Frommeyer, who is, I will say, he's an entrepreneur from the Eugene area here. So we're blessed with great individuals, a breadth and depth of interest and wisdom that come to inform our discussions when the commission meets once a month. They are charged to do that. Mr. Chairman, there are several major trends affecting the transportation system, its providers and its users alike. Changing demographics. Over the last six decades, we have seen populations grow in the urban areas by as much as 200%. Now, this is compared with the increase of only 33% in the rural parts of the state here. So that demands a different look to the transportation system. In addition to that, our population is growing. As we project out to the 2030 time frame, what we see is our population growing by about 41%. The issues associated with this increasing population will be compounded by the baby boom generation, the graying of our population, and the needs that they will have to take on, the many options that they will look for. So we are transitioning not only as an agency, but I would submit to you as an industry, and the transportation system, its various assets, must evolve to meet the needs of a graying public here. State revenue continues to be pinched down here. There are many factors at play with regard to the state highway fund, but the revenues are flattening out. The inflationary bite is taking a big chunk out of the purchasing power of the trust fund. Debt service, again, policy decisions made in years past that have offered the opportunity to advance projects also come with a credit card payment that extends out 25 to 30 years. As of right now, this agency expends about $580 million in debt service over the biennium. Got to pay that. It's a rigid fee that at times complicates the cash flow realities of the department. And then just the footprint of the agency. The cost of doing business continues to grow, the personal service side here. Since 2003, another issue that's challenging us with regard to the revenue are the mileage, the vehicle miles traveled, the number of miles people drive. That continues to decline. Since 2003, we've seen that decline. Today, we at best are plateauing, but we continue to see a downward trend, or we remain flat. The reality of less driving reduces fuel that's sold at the gas pump. That affects revenues and reduces the money entering the state highway trust fund here. The bottom line is this creates a challenge to this agency for maintaining, preserving, and operating our transportation asset. greater fuel efficiency. The composition of the fleet is changing. I think this is the result of both technology and policy here. So technology conversations in terms of electric vehicles, batteries, hydrogen cell, whatever the technology is, I am sure there's smart people somewhere working in a garage that will come up with the next advancement of technology that will advance the efficiency that we're seeing in the fleet here. CAFE standards, again, a federal policy that now has us somewhere in between the mid 20 miles per gallon, projecting out to 2016, that increases to 35 miles per gallon, and then to 2025. The expectation will be that vehicles will have a fuel efficiency rating of 54.5 miles per gallon in just a dozen years or so here. Again, the reality there is benefits maybe in the environmental and sustainability worlds, but reduces the revenue, the people going back to the pump that generates the monies that we infuse back into the transportation system. So somewhat of a double-edged sword when we talk about that. Move from the state, move to the federal area. We've got an uncertainty at the federal level. Again, they passed a federal reauthorization bill, the big surface transportation bill that funds transportation, highways and transit. They passed that in July of 2012, but it was only a 27-month bill. So we moved to a transportation fiscal cliff in October of 14 because the expenditures and the revenues at the federal level are out of sync. There is an exposure of between $12 and $15 billion that if passed as prologue, they'll go back to the federal general fund. They've done it to the tune of $55 billion to make the highway trust fund whole here. But that appears to us very shortly at the end of 2014, October 2014. The feds have to make a move one way or the other, or we're looking at potential reductions from federal monies here. These uncertainties have huge implications in the way we, our local government partners, plan. Yes, sir.
Excuse me, I was looking for a good place to interrupt. Representative Benz has a question.
Can you go back to that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, can you go back to that for just a moment and touch on that again, the reduction of what percentage if that $15 billion was not picked up?
So if you what we believe is if nothing is done to raise the federal gas tax, again, that hasn't happened since 1993, or any other revenue source to cover the $12 to $15 billion gap, what we would see is the potential for about a 25% reduction in federal funds flowing to Oregon in that 2015 time frame.
And the question would be, how much would the gas tax at the federal level have to go up to fill that gap?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Benz, I'm going to have to get you the specifics. I don't want to come off the top of my head and probably be wrong. So let me get back to you.
Another question. And the last time the federal gas tax was raised?
1993.
Thank you.
So we continue on in some of the impacts here. Aging infrastructure. Again, the transportation infrastructure, much like our population, is getting older. It's more expensive to maintain and preserve and expand. We have interchanges and bridges that are between 50 and 80 years old. I can look at the rail infrastructure. It's older than that time frame as well. So taken together, these trends provide some formal challenges to the Department of Transportation and our local government transportation partners to maintain, preserve, and strategically grow our transportation asset. Now, our ability to meet these challenges, or at least respond as effectively as possible, depends on the way we do business. I would submit that we have to challenge the traditional ways of doing business. We must manage the transportation system differently. We must better integrate not only the divisions of ODOT in a more aggressive manner, but also the relationships we have with local governments and our sister state agencies. We need to look across and maximize the resources that we have and target the investment strategies to reach the outcomes we need. We also need to find a sustainable funding source for multimodal transportation investment here. Again, the gas tax, we're having a conversation with you and your colleagues throughout this legislative session, looking at a transition from the gas tax to a mileage-based fee, looking at how we fund the non-highway modes. So again, a comprehensive conversation needs to be engaged as well. The Oregon Transportation Plan that we spoke to earlier, I believe, provides a roadmap. It is the 25-year vision document approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission. Looks at all modes of transportation as a single system, an integrated system, a multimodal system here. Its goals, policies, and strategies address the core challenges and opportunities that we face here in the state of Oregon. During the development of this, there were six priorities: maintaining existing transportation system to maximize the value of the asset, optimize system capacity and safety through technology, integrate transportation, land use, economic development, and the environment. That really is the trinity that comes together in any conversation when you're in the community. How do we better integrate those discussions and those policy directives and investment strategies? Fourth, to integrate the transportation system across jurisdictions, ownership, and modes. Okay, are the right people owning the system for all intents and purposes? We need to create a sustainable funding source for transportation, and we need to strategically invest in capacity enhancement, strike surgically at freight bottlenecks. These six priorities or principles underpin the goals contained in the OTP and its implementation framework. I want you to know, as an agency and as a commission, we always anchor back to these priorities and goals. What I'd like to do now, Mr. Chairman, is turn to Ms. Bohart, who will speak to the goals and how they are defined by specific policies as well as specific strategies.
Thank you. Ms. Bohart.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, committee members. For the record, Jerry Bohart, Transportation Development Division Administrator. Thank you, Director Garrett. So as mentioned, the Oregon Transportation Plan is our long-range multimodal plan. And so it looks at airports, it looks at bike, pedestrian, it looks at highways, roadway, ports, public transportation, railroads. It really is a policy direction for the agency. And the Oregon Transportation Plan that was adopted back in 2006 was not the first one. We actually had the first one back in 1991. And it really has set the tone for the work that the agency does.
Is that a typical gap between the two, or how often is it refreshed?
Terry, good question. Typically, we look at about 10 years, and we started the update of the Oregon Transportation Plan, I want to say, in around 2003, so it's a little bit longer than we had anticipated. So as Director Garrett talked about those kind of those key areas, the themes really within the vision were about how do you foster prosperity, how do you enhance mobility, how do you preserve livability, and that was really the essence of what the Oregon Transportation Plan was all about. It is important to note that it actually is a requirement, and the Oregon Transportation Plan really fulfills three requirements simultaneously. One is under federal requirements, federal highways, we're required to do a long-range transportation plan. The Oregon Transportation Commission is also required to do a long-range transportation system plan, as well as our state planning goal, Goal 12, has a similar requirement. So we actually make sure that this document meets all of those requirements. And I would be remiss to say that the 2006 plan was really developed under the leadership of Commissioner Ackerman. And we had a number of committees and a number of stakeholders working on it, but it was really her guidance and directed that led to the document that we now have. And as part of that, in one of the next steps of the Oregon Transportation Plan is a requirement to do the State of the System report, and I think you all have been provided a copy of that. So this is actually the third version. So every 2 years, we do an update of how we've been implementing the Oregon Transportation Plan, identify some trends, all the kind of the information that Director Garrett provided to you. So what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about two of the key goals, and then I'm going to turn it over to Paul Mather, and he's going to finish up with the other five goals.
And let me break in just for a moment and say that I have to head off to another committee to testify on one of my bills, so I'm going to hand the gavel to Vice Chair Benson in just a moment, and I'll be back as soon as I can. So my departure is nothing reflective of what you're saying, but I'll be back.
Thank you, Chair. So the first goal around mobility and accessibility. And this is really around enhancing Oregon's quality of life and economic vitality. And it's important to remember we actually differentiate in our policies and our strategies between mobility and accessibility. So mobility is about the ability of people and freight to move from one place to another safely and efficiently, where accessibility is around ensuring that we can reach our destinations and that we have choices in how we reach our destinations. And embedded in this goal is also about developing a balanced, integrated transportation system, again, with modal choices. And I think that the pictures that you see here on the Salem multimodal hub is a really great example of, I think, as an agency of what we're trying to achieve and what the Oregon Transportation Plan was really intended to do. This hub is about providing options. It looks at railroads. It has bus. It has bike. It's about connecting cities, and it's about providing connections within the city. So you can take a bus to downtown Salem or a bike, you know, just gives you options to get to the places that you need to get to. And one of the really neat things about the Salem Mobility Hub was the partnerships that it developed. So there was money provided by the city, by the state. We had a private investment by Greyhound. So everybody really worked in putting this partnership together. So, and what's really key about it is what's about being intermodal and being seamless. So,
excuse me for a moment.
Yes.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'm very drawn to this concept of multimodal hubs, and I've been talking for a few years about a concept that several people have told me they're interested in, and it relates very specifically to train stations, that it's not enough to attract new riders or to increase the options for business travel, moving up and down the valley, for example, for business meetings, to just connect with a bus, that if we could be much more aggressive in partnerships with private parties, either individuals or firms that do cars, like either right. an enterprise or the Zipcar concept, right. where you just pick it up there, that would capture a new category of rider that really needs and wants to use the train if they could then more or less immediately get their next mode of transportation to go off to the meeting or whatever they were doing.
Right. Vice Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson. Exactly. One of the things that we're really working on, whether you're talking about passengers or whether you're talking about freight, is that last mile. Because if you don't have that last mile, again, whether it's freight moving off of the interstate into the port or whether it's the person coming to the train station and trying to get wherever they're trying to get to, we have to be more complete in our thinking around the last mile. And that is definitely something that we're actively working on with our partners, because that is key, I think, to a lot of these types of successful initiatives.
Thank you for the response.
So goal two is around improving the efficiency of the system, optimizing operations and management, and extending the life of the various assets that we have to our full extent. So a lot of this is, you know, getting the biggest bang out of the buck that you can out of the transportation system. I think you heard Director Garrett talk about the increasing demands on our system because of demographics and as well as some of the financial limitations that we have. So how do we address some of the congestion issues that we have? And in the looking at the efficiency of our system, we really looked at two aspects. One that we call reoccurring congestion, so that's, you know, when you're going through rush hour, you always are kind of guaranteed what's going to happen when you hit downtown Portland, versus the non-reoccurring, which could be weather, which could be an unfortunate crash situation, which could be construction. And so we really were looking at what do we do to enhance our system from both of those. So one of them, which I'm sure you all are very familiar with, is Trip Check. That actually has been around for 10 years, and last year they got over 30 million visits to the website. And so people are really trying to understand, you know, what's the weather, what are some of the choices if there's an accident, how do I make different decisions?
If I might interrupt, I think half of those are mine, actually.
Just, no, there's an app you can put on your phone. So anyway, you can see that it's a very effective tool. And one that we continue to enhance. The other is ramp metering. Excuse me.
Thank you. A follow-up on that point about who's using TripCheck. Are there any private entities using TripCheck in an automated way to push out information or make information available, you know, via iPad and iPhone. So are we, as the public, providing a service, basically at no cost, that the private sector is utilizing to add value to customers?
Vice Chair Bence, Representative Nathanson, not so much through TripCheck, but we do provide the information. And there are private sector entities that bundle the information and target that information to their customers. So there is somewhat of a relationship between how that information is generated mm-hmm. and then how the private sector bundles it up and gives it to delivers it to its clients.
That does raise an interesting issue about through our public resources providing resources that someone else is able to use for their business and whether there is a value to that. Well, I'll leave it at that for right now. I think you know.
Can I follow up on
that? Vice Chair, for a sec.
Representative Nathanson, just when she was speaking, it reminds me that if you listen to the traffic reports on Portland radio stations, they say something about being at the ODOT Traffic Command Center. So I assume that they're at a central location where they can see all of the various traffic cameras and then they're reporting out on their radio station.
Is that accurate?
Is it accurate?
Yeah. No, that's correct. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Is there any charge for them to do that?
No, sir.
Okay. So it ties into what you said.
Thank you.
I think the one thing that I would add to, you're right about the value of the data. It's kind of that give and take conversation because the applications that they put forward as private entities work on this benefits us. So it's kind of that partnership that I think that Galen McGill, who heads up our ITS, has really used to his full benefit as he's developed the trip check. So,
and perhaps you could share with us the cost of the service.
Vice Chair Bence, I'll have to get back to you on that information. So it's not a program that I manage. So
that would be great. Thank
maintenance
you.
Does that. So the other one of the other efficiencies that we see here, many of you are probably aware of it, ramp metering. So making sure that the flow of the interstate you'll be seeing some ramp meters on the Beltline as part of one of the JTA projects. And then I think the other one that's probably perhaps of most interest is what we're calling the Active Traffic Management Project on 217. So really recognizing that there are some pretty severe congestion issues on 217, partly because of the intersect spacing and partly because the crashes that we see happening on 217, what are some of the mechanisms that we can do to reduce those? So you're going to see construction of new message signs, really inform drivers of travel time, something that you see on I-5. You know, how long is it going to take you to get to some of these key destinations? Warning of congested conditions or incidences. And then we'll be installing new signs that really talk about, you know, what's the speed that you should be traveling. So reducing the speed that's actually posted there. Because what we have seen and what history has shown is when people do that, you see obviously a lot less crashes. And obviously that reduces the amount of time of congestion and so on and so forth. So that effort is underway. And then finally, what I would say is, as part of goal two,
if I may,
sure.
So I can't recall if we discussed this before, but selling advertising space on some of these things, and all joking aside, has that been coming up in your conversations? So when people go on, like I do all the time, to check to see how the road looks over by Riley. Could we have that massive store that's at Riley buy a little advertising space to tell me to slow down when I drive through? And I'm saying that only because so many, you've got 2 million people looking. What's been our position on that?
Mr. Chairman, we've been extremely conservative. We've had conversations with the Federal Highway Administration. They are somewhat adverse to advertising, but the conversation is shifting, becoming more entrepreneurial. and maybe this is nothing more than an outgrowth of the promotion of public-private partnerships. I'm seeing a change in the tone of the discussion. I think it's something that we need to look at, whether it's through our maps, whether it's through our CHIP treks, maybe it's through our incident response vehicles, where we have private sector entities sponsoring those vehicles rather than taking that money out of our maintenance budget. Those are conversations that we're right at the infancy, right at the cusp in having. I think there's been a change in the discussion, and we should look forward to it. We've also seen that discussion change with regard to the rest area, a conversation that played itself out last legislative session before your colleagues here. And there's an opportunity to be a little more entrepreneurial with that. That might be a foundation that we jump off in terms of not so much advertising, but the words mean something here, maybe sponsoring certain things as well. So we're working with our federal partners who have big influence in this conversation.
Thank you.
So the last point that I'd make is around what we call tools to prolong the life of infrastructure. So this is what we refer to as our asset management program. And it's really collecting the right data at the right time about the life of our assets, whether we're talking about bridge or whether we're talking about culverts, and so that we are using it to its fullest extent possible, but then finding that point in time where we don't have to do a major reconstruction, or it allows us, in the case of culverts, to be more strategic about the culverts that we replace. If we know the condition of them, you know, whether it's worse first in the case of culverts, then we're more strategic about our investment and how we expend our funds there. And really, an asset management program is not just about our highway assets, and you can see here pictures of signs, but also fleet. Bus also has it with regards to their fleet. Railroads also have it with regards to their trains and their tracks. And so this is really key, I think, to the whole transportation system, regardless of whether we're talking about our assets or just the transportation system assets as well. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Paul Mather, unless you have any questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm going to walk you through the next several goals, starting with the economic vitality goal. Obviously, there's a connection between transportation and the economy. And I want to start by just looking back over the last decade and the investments that we've made in transportation over the last decade. The slide that I have up here depicts the amount of projects and the type of projects that we have throughout the state, whether it's the OTA 1, 2, 3 projects, the Connect Oregon projects, the federal stimulus dollars, or the JTA projects. As you can see, we've touched every corner of the state in very significant ways.
Paul, I can't really see my corner of the state. It's covered up with Portland. Quite the Lakeview has been destroyed.
Okay, we actually have lake views on there. There's sections of Bass Junction. I think that's Miss Bass Station and Burns Junction that's missing. But we've got Jordan Valley made.
Oh, you're right. You're exactly right. You've taken Crane out too.
Yeah.
So it's a lesson learned in that question.
You're exactly right. There is Lakeview. If I may, though, this is an extremely valuable slide, and I've used it a lot in many of my town halls to try to give people a view of how well dispersed the investment of ODOT and the state is across the entire scope of our counties. So it's a great slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This next slide actually paints a similar picture, but this looks at where the paychecks went to, specifically out of the OTA 3 bridge program. As you those of you that are around when we passed the OTA 3 bridge program in 2003, one of the specific goals that we had for that program was to create jobs in Oregon. This slide represents over the last 10 years where the money from that specific program went to. We can tell you that 82% of the dollars spent in the program itself stayed in Oregon, and these are the communities in Oregon that were touched with paychecks in people's hands. Next, I want to walk you through, again, kind of looking back over the last 10 years, just kind of walk you through these various programs and just give you a sense of the size and scope of the various programs. First, starting with the OTA 1, 2, and 3 programs. These programs represent about $3 billion in investments. We're just wrapping this program up. It includes the $1.3 billion for Oregon Bridges. We have, of the 365 bridges identified in that program, we have all of them complete. At the end of this year, we'll have all of them complete except one that won't be open to traffic. We've been able to say we delivered this program on time and on budget. The Connect Oregon 1, 2, 3, and 4 programs represents a $340 million investment of lottery-backed bonds. These investments are in non-highway projects, again, throughout the state that you saw in the previous map. But they also leverage nearly $500 million in additional funding from private and public sources. The JTA program, which was passed in 2009, represents another $300 billion for state, county, and city roads and streets. We're in the process, as you can see in this graph, we're in the process of implementing that. Many of those large JTA projects will be going to construction this season and next season. In the midst of this, we also had the federal stimulus program, which contributed another $500 million. Half of that went for highway projects, half of that went for various modes of rail, transit, bike, and ped projects. Together represents about a $7 billion investment in the transportation system. As we look at the highway component of that, if you total up the budget for all those projects together, represents about a 1% under budget delivery of those programs and projects. So I want to walk you through some of the performance measures. As we look at the department's performance during this record time of construction and delivery, what's been our track record on bringing projects in on time? Here's one of our key performance measures of bringing projects from the design phase to the construction phase. As you can see, we have a target of 80% of being on time, and we're consistently around 90% on time. Look at construction projects that are completed on time. If you follow the KPA definition of contracts, of a contract being completed, you see the lower line. The upper line is actually when the project is open to traffic. Again, we hover right around that 80% or better line, depends on your definition. If you look at, the important one, projects on budget. Again, what I just said, here's the total amount of projects delivered during this 10-year period. We are 1% under budget, or $24 million under budget of the entire program.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is a significant conversation, I think, because it wasn't too long ago we had a discussion where a specific project, Pioneer Mountain Eddyville, this is the Highway 20 from the Corvallis area to the coast Newport area. It was a project that has been highlighted and articulated as the agency's inability to deliver a significant project on time. Well, again, that is one project, and yes, we stumbled, mea culpa. We, of course, corrected. We will build that project. It's been a difficult conversation, but again, I think we owe it to the folks from the valley to the coast and the businesses along that way to finish that project. And the price overrun has been significant. But again, what Mr. Mather just described is, now step back and look at the whole of the chessboard here. And over a 10-year period, you look at the project program overall, and you will see from the time our commission gavels down our price for a project, over that 10-year period, we actually come in under budget. So there are some plus and minuses, but more minuses to the tune of delivering this program under budget. That ranks us very highly as we compare ourselves to our sister states. So this is something to be very proud of. I think it shows a discipline in the way we deliver our program. It not only plays itself out in terms of projects on the ground, but it also plays itself out in terms of the credit rating the department has. We have one of the highest credit ratings of the Department of Transportation across the nation here. So these fiscal disciplines, these project delivery disciplines go hand in hand here. And I think if someone wants to take the time and step back and look at the overall project delivery, you can certainly cite individual areas where we may stumble. But overall, you have a Department of Transportation that delivers on its investment and is a good investment in terms of the return of the investment packages that we have seen since the OTAs, through the Connects, through the Jobs and Transportation Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
I'll defer to Representative Cameron.
Oh, sorry, Representative Cameron.
Well, we're going to argue over who goes first. Thank you, Director, for being here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, you've got a, you're showing the track record delivery on budget. Do we have any numbers over the same period of time that would show and I'm just trying to figure out an example here, what it costs per lane mile in the state of Oregon to, like, for example, to put down pavement compared to those other states that we're comparing ourselves to on time as well, the cost. I mean, we talk about investment and return. We have that information.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, what I can say is there's not an ordinary project. I wish I could say there is, here's the average pavement preservation project, and it's about $1 million a mile. Well, it's going to be dependent. I'm going to say it depends on whether it's an urban or a rural pavement project. It's going to depend whether there are other amenities, are there safety issues that need to be involved. So to get to your point of trying to have an apples-to-apples comparison is somewhat difficult. That said, we will do our very best to show that over time, here's what it costs to do our work. What were the material cost activities going on here, and what that meant as we laid projects down. So we may have to be somewhat surgical and identify a project and then itemize out what we paid for. I guess, Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying, Representative, we may have to answer your question in almost an iterative type approach until we get it right here. But we'll bring forth the information to try to answer your question. I understand that. I understand the intent of the question. It's just the way we gather information and really trying to address what you say, we're going to have to play with a little bit. So, Paul, maybe you have a better answer than that. But.
Representative Cameron, we'll get back to you. Like the director said, I think it's difficult even within the state of Oregon to come up with a typical project in eastern Oregon, central Oregon, again, rural, urban. But we can take a shot at it and get back to you.
Follow up. Thank you. Well, maybe just a similar state. Washington has similar terrains that we do, and maybe they've laid similar miles of interstate over a period of time. I'd just be interested to... You know, as in business, you're always comparing yourself to somebody else who may be doing it a little bit more efficiently than you. And if we could look outside our state to see the efficiencies, that's all I would.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Good.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I wonder if you could comment on, A, what ODOT has learned from some of the projects that have gone over budget, and, B, what is the current sort of state of the art in project forecasting, budgeting? What tools does ODOT use to attempt to ensure that projects, and as you've shown, have successfully on average come under budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, we certainly learned a lot on the projects that have gone well. The director talked about Pioneer Mountain in particular, how we use the particular contracting tool called design build. While it's a very effective tool for us, the application of that in that particular situation with the known or unknown information we had at the time of letting that contract, certainly we've learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Learned a lot about our relationship with design firms, our relationship with contractors. We've been very successful overall with our programs and with design build. We've been successful in trying other tools such as CMGC, which we're using on the bridge in Eugene Springfield on I-5 very successfully, and again a different relationship we have with the designer and with the contractor. We're continuing to learn on all those fronts with the different contracting methods that we have, and continue to apply those lessons. We bring the contracting community in almost as a practice now before we let projects. We have constructability reviews with them. They give us advice on how to package contracts, how to word contracts in a way that they can be more efficient. And we take that as an advisement to be more efficient in our contracting and managing our projects. So it's an ever learning process. As new tools, we try different techniques from other industries in a contracting way. But also in specifically as we apply those in specific projects, there's learnings that we have as well.
Thank you.
Representative Ken.
Vice Chair Benz, delighted to have you here. This is very interesting information for me. I come from a part of the world where bridges are critical to movement of not only people but freight and everything else that comes to the coast. And we have a very large bridge that you have done a wonderful job over a period of now a couple of years of doing a large rehabilitation project on a big highway bridge, the McCullough Bridge. And we've watched that with great interest, and it's gone very, very smoothly. I appreciated your comments, Director Garrett, on rail infrastructure. It is older than highway infrastructure, so we do have some work to do in that regard in the state. But could you give me just a sense of where you are on, in the spirit of prolonging life of infrastructure as you're talking today, where we are in highway infrastructure for bridge rehabilitation? I mean, we're seeing it in our part of the world, but are we 20% there, 30% there, 50% there, and what do we see in the future as far as highway bridge infrastructure particularly?
I think, Mr. Chairman and Representative McEwen, if I can, I'll punt to the highway guy.
Please.
And Mr. Representative, I'd actually just to wait a few slides. I'm going to get to that particular point, and we're going to talk about bridges and pavements, and I think answer your question directly with a chart I have.
Great.
So moving on to the next goal, sustainability. I want to talk a little bit about how we've applied some of the LoadSafe direction that we had in 2001, which have passed some policy direction for us, as well as in 2009 and 10, some specific direction around energy and climate change. We've taken this direction very seriously. We have developed a series of documents within the department to change or enhance our practices around how we construct projects, as well as how we conduct our daily business within ODOT. I just want to walk through a couple examples here I have on the slide, first starting with our own building here in Salem, the transportation building. As many of you know, we just went through a major rehabilitation of that building. I'll tell you that 84%, or about 960 tons of material from that building, was either reused or recycled, and we're targeting a LEED Gold certification for that building. The next picture over is really a common picture on most of our construction sites, where the contractor is recycling the steel and reusing the concrete on the project itself. On this particular project, over 700 tons was recycled just on that project. The next two slides there, the Hunter Creek, the one titled Hunter's Creek, and the I-5 Eugene project. As many of you know, on I-5, as we were building the bridge in Eugene Springfield area, we had a temporary bridge that we had to put in place because of the condition of the existing bridge. That temporary bridge was in place for almost 10 years. As we now complete the construction of the new bridge, the beams in that temporary bridge are still useful, and we're using those around the state, and one of those is in Curry County there in the picture in Hunters Creek. Again, another example of how we're repurposing or reusing building materials on our projects. As we look to our maintenance yards.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative.
Thank you. For my colleagues on this committee who are new to this committee, who didn't serve with me last year, you didn't get to hear me thank the department for all of their efforts in reusing the adaptive reuse of materials. I'm really excited about it for several different reasons. There are environmental and financial reasons that drive us to this, and it's something to be very proud of. And I also think it's sort of interesting that I always thought we were calling this the I-5 Bridge Project. Now, apparently something else has usurped that name.
Thank you, Representative Nasons. And just taking that point a little bit further, as we look at our maintenance yards, our maintenance crews now use 37% of the fuels are made up of biodiesel. In our facilities, we've reduced the amount of natural gas that we use since 2004. We've reduced that by 22% in our facilities. I think one of the things that we're going to have conversations this session with and in the future with is our spray program and the use of the materials that we use to control vegetation on our roadways. We have a commitment to reduce the amount of active ingredients we use in our spray program by 25% over a five-year period. We're 2 years into that, and we're pleased with the results that we're seeing so far, but want to run the complete five-year test pilot on that. Looking around the organization, there's many examples that we use to promote sustainability. DMV, for example, does 25,000 transactions online and saves transactions in person. Our motor carrier division offers 78 different services online to the trucking community. One of the things that's more visible, and we've got some recent press about, is the electric charging stations that we've been putting in place. We've used various federal grants to put a network of charging places along the I-5 corridor, and then beginning to build off of that network on the I-5 corridor throughout the state.
Do we have any idea how much use they're getting?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that off the top of my head, but I'm sure we can get that for you.
Thank you.
I can tell you that just the electric vehicles, Oregon is a leader in just the amount of electric vehicles that we have compared to other states. But I can get you more specific numbers around both those topics.
Representative McKeown.
Vice Chair Benz, could you explain the legend on this map to me? What is the orange dot as compared to the yellow, the pink, and the blue?
Mr. Chair, Representative McKeown, that is the stage of when they are being complete. So the yellow ones are the first stage. No, I take that back. That's not right. It was I'll have to get back to you on that. I thought it was the staging in which we were building them. But the I-5 ones are complete, and we're building out from there. I believe it has to do with the different funding sources that we have for the different stations. We had different funding grants that came in different time frames. The ones that are shown there in pink, maybe you're concerned with there in the Coos Bay area, those have yet to be built. I think it's 2014 they're projecting to have those complete.
Just to follow. So what I'm seeing here are only charging stations that you are putting in place. There are some, for example, a new fire station was built in Coos Bay, and they put charging stations in at the new fire station. Those wouldn't be counted in this map. You're only talking about things that you are actually putting
in. That's correct.
Okay,
that's
thank
correct.
You.
That's correct.
The city of Tigard has two or three.
Okay. Get that to her.
Thank you.
So moving on to the next goal of safety and security, I want to talk a little bit about fatal accidents in the state. Oregon, in the last century, spent much of that century on the different side of this graph, where we were challenged with reducing fatalities in this state, and we had a high number compared to the rest of the nation, and we were well above the national average. During the last 10 years, though, we've seen a steady decline in fatalities, and our ranking nationally has continued to go up. We're very proud of this. But we have more work to do. Obviously, even with the low numbers that we have, there's more work to be done to reduce fatalities on our highways. We have two specific bills that are going to be in front of this committee on Friday. House Bill 2264 will expand the teen driver ed. It's a proven dynamic, dramatically reducing teen crash rates. House Bill 2265 to improve safety in our work zones. We experience about 500 crashes every year in our work zones, about 9 fatalities every year. And we believe both these bills will help reduce the serious and fatality and fatal accidents in the state.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is important because this is who we are as an organization. We are a safety organization, and this is just not a one-time thing. What you're seeing is a trend that has lasted over a dozen years here. That's different than some states. Some states are aggressive. They have good years. The state of Oregon, because of its partnership, again, led by Troy Costales in our Transportation Safety Division. Troy and his people are nothing short of outstanding. They are national leaders. There's no question about it. But to complement that resource, we have the courts, we have law enforcement, and we have the various safety advocates. And then the automobile manufacturers. The cars are safer. The combination of that effort has yielded saving many, many lives over the decade. And again, as I said, this is not a short trend. This is a trend that now plays itself out into the 12th year. And I think that's important to hear because we're doing good things here in the state of Oregon. And again, to Representative Cameron's, it's also good to compare yourself with other states. We compare very well in terms of the safety indicators.
Yes, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director. I did a ride-along here with the state police in Salem, and I want to thank the department for moving ahead to make some turnarounds safer for the state police as they were doing some spin-outs doing that. And the other thing I observed over the last 8 years in doing those ride-alongs is a lot more awareness on the public's point or part in calling in drivers that have problems and the state police responding to that. So I know that has helped get some people off the road that probably shouldn't be driving.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, strong partnership with local law enforcement, but with our partners at the Oregon State Police. What you're going to hear in terms of the safety conversation will play itself out over and over again. It's not only the partnerships, but the issues of engineering, enforcement, emergency services. It's the combination of those. There's another E that I just can't remember right now, but the four E's that we speak to, they all come together to make it happen. And again, the partnership is as strong as it has ever been at my time at ODOT.
So just how are you publicizing this good fact? How do the citizens of Oregon know this excellent job? Because I agree with you, watching Troy, you guys over the past 5 years has been nothing short of amazing because you've been making progress during that period of time. How do you let the world know, the world we're interested in Oregon, what you're doing?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, we don't do a very good job of marketing. I'll be very blunt. We just do our job. So we use opportunities before you and your colleagues here. We have, we are an agency that touches people's life every day and across the state. We have various forums that we engage this conversation. Do we advertise? No, we don't. We just try to, through the various networks we have, we try to make sure that the information is put out there. We certainly spread the gospel at the national level as well through the various trade associations and using their network to share the information. We use that vehicle as well. But could we do a better job? Yeah, I'd be the first one to admit that we could do a much better job.
I'm going to shift gears and talk a little bit about security. One of the things, frankly, that keeps me up at night is thinking about the major earthquake and tsunami that we're likely to face, or the experts say that we're predicted to face in the state. And really, are we prepared as a state and specifically as a Department of Transportation for that? And the answer is no. As we look around the world and see the similar type of earthquakes and tsunamis that hit Chile and hit Japan, Southeast Asia, and even we see the effects of Katrina, the experts tell us that there's going to be three disasters that are going to play themselves out. One is the initial loss of life, and they estimate in Oregon anywhere from 10 to 20,000 people. And then with the infrastructure down and not being able to respond, there's going to be a secondary loss of life, anywhere from 5 to 10,000 people. And then even a longer-term impact, and that's going to be to the economy. As Oregon struggles to get back on its feet, businesses are also going to be struggling to preserve their business. And as they do that, many of them are going to choose to pick up and move somewhere else that has a more reliable infrastructure to do their business with them. So we look at those things, and we look at how can we as the Department of Transportation and our highway system in particular be better prepared to respond or be ready for this. We've developed information, a report specifically on a network of routes, which show here on the picture. This is a phase one, which we think is kind of our very first, very minimal piece that we have to have in place to have any kind of response, tying up north-south networks through I-5 and 97, and then slowly, as we can, move towards the coast, which is really going to be ground zero for the emergency that we're going to be facing.
Yeah, I can't help but notice that Burns and Lakeview are left out again.
And Mr. Chair, in this case, you're probably fortunate.
Happy for that.
Yeah,
yes.
Happy. We'll trade.
For the new capital of Oregon.
Yeah, right. Lakeview. Lakeview. Yeah.
So this is a network that we've built. Again, this is just, go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, the studies suggest that people are far more interested in spending money after the disaster than before.
Okay. Right.
And so, and even one points this out. So what is the, what are we doing? I know we've had this conversation.
Right.
What are we doing to try to suggest to folks that $46 after, and the cost is dramatically less in advance.
Correct.
So what are we doing?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the point I'm going to, is that we've completed the economic analysis just on the economics piece, not on the loss of life that I described, but just if you look at the economy, you know, the economy relative to the transportation system. We believe for every dollar you invest in preserving that system now, we'll save $46 impact to the economy when this event happens.
But it's a time value issue, isn't it? Everyone's going to say what's going to happen in 100 years, so why invest the dollar today? So the issue is one of immediacy, I suppose.
And Mr. Chair, we don't, frankly, again, listening to the experts, we don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen
this afternoon,
it could happen next year, it could happen 100 years from now. We don't know. But we do know when it does happen, there's going to be catastrophic impacts to the state.
Right. And is there a plan to publicize this now that you have the study? What's going to happen with the work?
Mr. Chair, the resilience study is going to be published later this month. Well, it actually came out, but I believe there's going to be hearings on that later this month. And as part of that, we're going to be talking about the highway component of that and these economic numbers. But it's something that I would tell you, our commission, it's very high on their radar screen. I know the director, this is a high priority for him. This is something we believe we're very far behind on, and we need to do a lot of work to catch up and be ready. So I want to transition to funding.
Excuse me, Representative Gorzak.
Just really briefly, so I would, tell me if I'm wrong, I would assume that ODOT is working with the emergency management people pretty closely in terms of this. And so are there, if you think about, for instance, the Portland-Vancouver area and all of the bridges and the problems that we will inevitably face there, have there ever been any considerations of, for instance, having an old couple of Washington State ferries moored at Portland that could be put into service, things like that, so that we could have some cross-river traffic if need be?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gorsuch, it's part of this conversation. Again, we have been engaged. It's a cross-discipline team, and you know as well as I, as you look at the potential that comes with a Cascadia seismic event, it will ripple up the coastlines of Oregon and Washington, much like a zipper. Right. That's where it goes. I think it has to be a bi-state conversation because the exposure is tremendous here. And I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to kind of share my thoughts on that. Paul touched on the overarching themes, but I think we have to ask ourselves this. If you have an opportunity to save lives, what we do know is we're going to lose 10,000 to 20,000 people with the first hit. That's just a consequence of this situation. We know the geologic clock has been ticking. And the bell will toll some, very high probability within the next 30 to 50 years here. If you can save the next wave of loss of life, another 5,000 to 10,000 people, because you can now get in and triage them because you've laid down and armored up a transportation corridor to move people to medical facilities, I would believe that's a good investment by itself. But to the business impacts, again, what we've learned from the Gulf states, from Japan, is you can't keep the supply chains intact for two to three weeks is about as long as they last. If that goes away and atrophies, then what happens is the businesses leave and they don't come back. Again, that's the longer term economic impact here. So I think what we have in front of us is a roadmap to say, here's what you can do. We've taken the cross disciplines of a lot of sister agencies and said, listen, here's where we need to go. I am of the opinion, foundational to taking the first step, you got to lay down the transportation foundation. Look forward to having this conversation with you and your colleagues as we move through the legislative session.
And just really quickly, the other piece to that is that this sort of earthquake we're talking about is Northern California coast all the way up to BC. So it's not as if you could rely on Seattle or really even San Francisco. This is going to be a major event and requires an incredible amount of preparation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're exactly right. And just to be blunt, we are woefully unprepared.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gorsuch.
Speaking of woefully unprepared, when I was on transportation last time, I kept thinking, how can they, I was on healthcare, they scare you in healthcare. How could they scare you in transportation until we had the seismic update and they talked about how many bridges would collapse. And I believe a couple of years ago it was 1,900 of the 2,500 bridges in Oregon-ish would collapse with Cascadia. Is that pretty much still?
Mr. Chair, still the figure. Exact number, but you're right. In Western Oregon, the majority of our bridges do not have seismic retrofit to them to prevent them from collapsing, and so you're going to see the majority of them in Western Oregon are going to be in some way damaged by the quake.
So that's how transportation can scare you.
Yes.
Right there.
Thanks for pointing that out, Representative Dorn.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
I hope you sleep well tonight.
She's being the bluebird of transportation happiness.
There you go.
So I'll move on. The next goal, talking about funding. We talk about the increase in miles per gallon of vehicles. We talk about vehicle miles travels being down. We really, sometimes those get kind of theoretical numbers, but what we can tell you how those two numbers come together is it's just in the sale of gasoline. And you look at the sale of fuel since 1987, you see a fairly uniform incline until about 2007, 2009 when we see a decline. And that decline is very significant to our revenue and to our funding.
How much of that do you attribute to the economic happenings?
Mr. Chair, obviously some of it is with the economy, but it's not all with the economy. If you look at the vehicle miles traveled, they actually started trending down well before the economy did. There's other dynamics clearly in play than just the economy. The economy is a significant piece, but the habits of younger drivers are changing. We're not seeing and issuing the licensing of younger drivers at our historic numbers. Just society is changing, and then how we use transportation, the demand for multimodal transportation has continued to increase. It's a dynamic world that's changing.
Just a moment.
Maybe you may have answered this while I was in the hall, but we were in revenue just 3 or 4 days ago, and we're told that there wasn't this decline in fuel sales. And it would be nice if you guys could speak with revenue, and Mazin was the one that indicated, and see if we couldn't see the two charts so we see where you guys are apart in your opinions. Because I'm guessing right. You're both right. You're probably
different data. Probably,
exactly, yeah. Right.
We'll sync those up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to illustrate the point, in 2009 we passed the Jobs and Transportation Act. And based on that, we sold bonds or in the process of selling bonds to support the projects that are specified in that bill. Looking at the projections that were based on, you see the line here from 2007 to 2009 carried forward, we're seeing about a 9% reduction over what the projected amount was going to be. And I'll illustrate that when we get to our budget, but that's a piece that you have to make up elsewhere in your programs. When you sell those bonds for those projects and you have those projects in the bill to construct, it puts pressure, as the director was talking about earlier, it puts pressures on other parts of your budget.
So before you go on, it looks like you may be switching a little bit. Does the curve that would show vehicle miles traveled show a similar curve, or is there a movement to more efficient vehicles that would account for some of this or complement some of it?
Mr. Chair, yes, yes to all that. We're seeing a decline in just vehicle miles traveled is going down. We're seeing an increase in miles per gallon, so people are choosing higher mile vehicles. And the net result of that, combined with the economy, creates this chart and creates a reduction in revenue for transportation. As the director said earlier, about 15% of our budget now goes to bond payments. So what is that? Another point I think I'll make here is we have a dedicated fund, which is the highway fund for transportation, and constitutionally it's limited to highway type activities, and there's an appetite, as I was mentioning, an appetite for other modes of transportation, whether it's bike, pedestrian, transit, rail. We're constitutionally limited in how we spend those highway funds, and so another need that we have is for a similar type of funding mechanism for that appetite that's out there for those other types of transportation other than highways. Getting to your bridge question that we talked about. So how does that play out in kind of real terms? Is our budgets are, as we're projecting our budgets to be down, our revenues to be down, how does that play out in our transportation system? So this chart shows you a pretty dire picture of where we look for our bridges to be over a fairly long period. If we look out towards 2040, 2050, 2060, turn the clock back to 2003 when we had the bridge conversation with OT03. At that point, we identified a $5 billion problem with our bridges. Knowing we didn't have the revenue at that point to deal with all the bridges, we strategically focused on the $1.3 billion program we came up with, the 365 bridges on those key freight routes on the interstate system. But in that, there's a whole group of bridges that were left behind or not dealt with that are going to come due over the next decades. Bridges get replaced on a 50 to 100 year cycle, so it takes a while for the numbers to go up, as you see very early in this chart, but then also to decline. We see a similar decline in our pavements, although it happens more quickly, in that we repave roads about every 15 to 20 years. As that funding goes down, it's going to show a more immediate direct correlation to the condition of our pavements. I can tell you from a maintenance standpoint, we're maintaining pavements. If the pavements are in good conditions or at the top of this chart, for every dollar I spend at that point, it takes me $10 when it's in a worse condition to bring it back up to that good condition. So from a financial standpoint, if we want to have a transportation system that from a financial standpoint is the most sustainable, the higher the condition you have it and the less we spend on maintenance, just keeping it in a deteriorated situation.
How much of the deterioration of pavement is on a kind of predictable straight line? Are there unpredictable or unexpected events that accelerate its deterioration?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's reasonably predictable. I mean, there's obviously factors from truck traffic that's on the road, historical damage on roads. Mountain passes, for example, have chain and stud damage that we see on them, or just the climates that they're in we'll see is different. But it's reasonably predictable. Sometimes we do have a particular design of pavements that we use have either a shorter or longer life than we anticipated, but it's fairly predictable.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
Just to follow up on that, a really basic question. In terms of pavement, sometimes I see ODOT use concrete, and sometimes I see asphalt on I-84. I think they started with concrete and then went back to asphalt. Is there one that's better than the other? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, they're both good.
Okay.
What typically the challenge is in the constructability of those. When you put down concrete, you have to have several weeks to months for that reconstruction to happen. If we're in an asphalt situation, we can literally go in overnight and repave the roadway and have it back open to traffic. And so as we have to take care of traffic or pavements in especially urbanized, dense traffic areas, we almost have to force to go to asphalt just from that standpoint. But as you point out, in Eastern Oregon, where the traffic volumes are less and we can put traffic into one lane for a period of time and do one lane at a time, oftentimes our cost-benefit numbers that we run between the two will show concrete better than asphalt, sometimes vice versa. But in those situations where we have the luxury to do a cost-benefit ratio, we'll do that between the two and use the most appropriate one. Typically in concrete, you have a life of about 40 years, where in pavements it's 15 to 20.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have in my town hall meetings used slides just like this many, many, many times. And I've used that space between your 78% and the other line as a savings account. I explain to people that they're using their savings account and try to express then to them at what point they're going to start moving out of that and into a deficit situation. Do you, and it's really been extremely well received. Well, it's not well received, but at least people understand what's going on. It's well understood, right? But the issue is one of being able to appropriately express this in a broad scale. So how do you do that? How does the department... Is it up to us, those of us that are on this committee and in legislature, to go back home and explain what's actually happening? Because this is the key to your entire
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think one of the opportunities I'm going to talk about here towards the close of my presentation is our Area Commission on Transportation. I know you're very familiar with those that we have throughout the state. They're a great voice for us in the community that can help us get the word out to various places. And as we talk about our program, we talk about cost, projects that they want to have, and we show graphs like this and show the investment that we need to make in our pavements and in our bridges, they get that connection between how much we invest in preserving what we have versus enhancing the system that we have. And both of these two slides I use often in my presentations, but I know that we use them in our area commissions and in other forums like that to get the word out.
Yeah, I would add a third one and show a gravel road with a flat tire, which I do all the time.
and it's hugely effective, so that they can see the future of the top, which we like, in the middle, which where we're going, and the bottom, which we might ultimately end up.
Yeah, it's a good suggestion, Representative Fitz.
So the next slide, I'm going to try to give you what I would describe as a back-of-the-napkin look at our budget. So obviously ODOT's a very big agency, and like a lot of big state agencies, we have a very complex budget. And as I work with our budget people to put the slide together, they were very nervous in trying to boil things down to being very simplistic. But I want to try to give you just something you can carry around kind of in your head. When we talk about different programs, we talk about just this point we were talking about with bridges and pavements, you can see how the transportation budget in the state is structured. So just quickly walking through this, there's the state highway fund, or the revenue that comes into the state, and it's split between ODOT and cities and counties. Cities and counties get a portion of the state funds as well as federal funds that come to the state. For example, the Jobs and Transportation Act, that increase was split 50-50 between ODOT and cities and counties. On the ODOT side, kind of moving our budget down, I put it into three basic boxes. The debt that we've been talking about is something we've got to pay first, and that represents about 15% of our budget. The operations side, on the other side, is just operating the agency from DMV to motor carrier to our maintenance program is the biggest piece of that. It's just the daily operation of the organization. The balance of that is we left for projects. As you move down to the project line, we have the one-time expenditure of those bonded projects, whether it's a JTA or the Connect Oregon projects that are funded through bonds. And then you have the ongoing funds over on the lower right there. The dedicated funds, we have a number of federal programs, whether it's CMAC programs or money we transfer to metropolitan planning organizations that are dedicated programs that have to be spent in a prescribed way, which really leads us with Representative Bench, just this discussion I was having, we have with our area commissions, is that policy decision that you have between fixing what you have and maintaining what you have versus enhancing what you have. And the way we've framed up our STIP, you'll hear us talk about our STIP, or it's really our capital program, how we frame that up for our commission, and we want them to make that policy decision between fix it, enhance, where do you spend that money? Once they've made that policy decisions, as Jerry Borda was talking about earlier, we have management systems for our culverts, for our pavements, for our bridges, and our safety program that will tell us where to spend the money, when to spend the money, the type of treatment to spend the money, and to get the most out of our money. On the enhancement side, we'll move to our area commissions on transportation and really help them, or ask them to help us with setting the priorities in their communities, whether that's a highway project or a bike ped project.
Could you remind us again what JTA stands for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, it's the Jobs and Transportation Act.
Got
so it was passed in 2009. Sorry,
that's
I keep using
2001.
I keep using that
2009 session.
Yeah. Keep using that acronym. Sorry. So that's again a thumbnail sketch. I wouldn't take this, over to Ways and Means and do a presentation on our budget with this. to carry around when we talk about policy issues, what the makeup of our budget is.
Representative McEwen and I will remember that.
Absolutely.
I have mentioned this several times already, but we have a network of area commissions of transportation around the state. This is a very effective tool for ODOT to integrate into communities, integrate into decision making. These groups are made up of city officials, county officials, as well as private businesses, transit districts, bike ped interests. The diversity of transportation is represented in each of these area commissions on transportation. They're invaluable to us as staff, but they're also invaluable to our transportation commission in bringing those local priorities forward to them when they have to make those decisions. We also have a variety of statewide committees that complement these area commissions on transportation. We have the Freight Advisory Committee, the Bike Ped Advisory Committee, the Public Transit, Rail Advisory, Safety Committee, a variety of statewide committees that also help advise the Transportation Commission. So with that, that's a run-through of the seven goals. I'll turn it back to the director.
Representative Betts has a question for you.
I can't help but note that white area up there, I don't know what counties that might be, but there doesn't seem to be any prioritization mechanism up there.
That's Representative Benz, that's the one area we do not have an area commission on transportation in. We have area commissions chartered with a charter with our transportation commission in every part of the state except essentially the tri-county area, including Hood River area around Region 1. We've been working towards that. As we go through this current process, the fix-it-and-hand process that we talk about in selecting projects, we have kind of an ad hoc group that we've formed, and we're hopeful that that will be part of the learning process for us and the local communities and how a body like that could work in the Portland metro area. Obviously, it's a very complex area in the Portland metro area and the role that Metro plays in the dynamics that are there. So there's a lot more complexities to figure out in the Portland metro area versus other parts of the state.
I can't help but say that someone can't get their act together. I'm sure that would be. I'm sure you haven't heard that before. Sorry. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mintz, we will put that on a short list of comments. Have the conversation.
Very short.
I guess, not to be redundant and to respect everyone's time here, first, I'm glad that we have a picture of the whole of the state here, including Representative Bence's Eastern Oregon County. Second, I remembered my fourth E, and that's education. So it's engineering, enforcement, emergency services, and education. So I feel better now that I've said that. I think let us end by saying, and Paul mentioned this, the Oregon Department of Transportation is a big, complex business. We touch people's life every day. And I can assure you that the men and women of ODOT understand the gravity of just that, whether it is the highway portfolio or maintenance folks or the folks, whether it's motor carrier or DMV, that are conducting business transactions with the public. The gravity of that and how we touch people's life, not lost on us at all. So as we look at these opportunities, these challenges here, rightfully so, the legislature as well the citizens demand that we have the best return on the tax dollar here. That's what we try to do here. So whether it's with the challenges of the uncertainties of revenues, the flows, the integration of programs, how do we maximize both our financial and our human resources here, we want to make sure that we are working hard to align our policies, our programs, and then our investment strategies. And so we're making sure that we have all voices sitting around the table informing the transportation debate. That is an aggressive engagement, and the ACT conversation is fundamental to that. We're actually revisiting the composition of who sits around the table at an area commission on transportation to make sure that, again, all voices are heard, because we are now looking to be a multimodal Department of Transportation. That's extremely important to us. Now, we have some funding issues, but let us take care of the structural issues in terms of the agency, bringing my resources together so the constituencies don't have to chase a specific color of money, don't have to chase a specific program, or chase a specific manager to that program here. We'll take care of that. Let them choose and prioritize the best projects, and we'll figure out how the money flows here. That is a direction we're moving. We're looking at strategic and surgical strikes with the monies we have in terms of capacity. So we spoke to the OT3 bridge investment. Again, critical freight routes. That was a jobs bill for all intents and purposes, and to make sure that commerce, goods, and services continue to flow across and through the state of Oregon. Whether it's the Jobs and Transportation Act, whether it's Connect Oregon, or potentially a bridge that crosses the Columbia River in the Portland metro area, the Columbia River Crossing. Again, surgical strikes as we move here. This will all take certain attributes in order for us to meet these challenges, take them on, and overtake them. We're going to need the attributes of creative thinking, collaboration, innovation, and hard work. And let me assure you, the Department of Transportation, those are attributes that make up the men and women of ODOT here. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we stand down. We appreciate this opportunity, and again, we'll take any additional questions you may have.
Thank you. I apologize for having been gone through the middle. It looks like you have asked some questions through that through your presentation, and obviously we will be having a lot of ongoing conversations with you as we confront a whole range of bills, and including next Monday night when we will be joining our colleagues in the Senate to talk about that bridge you mentioned. If there aren't any other comments for the good of the order, well, thank you all for your presentation, your good orientation, and I look forward to seeing you again. Close the work, or the informational meeting. And if there's nothing else, we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you.